Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case is about Communication and Cable of Chicago's masquerade as communications giant AT&T Broadband. This constituted a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act because Communications and Cable of Chicago was disguising its true identity to my clients in order to induce them to pay disputed debts. The lower court therefore erred in finding summary judgment for Communications and Cable of Chicago and AT&T Broadband LLC for three reasons. First, the lower court abused its discretion in relying upon the affidavits of three witnesses who were not disclosed during the course of discovery. Second, the district court abused its discretion because she did not even allow plaintiffs the opportunity to depose these three witnesses after they were introduced for the first time at summary judgment. And third, the district court erred.
Did you file a motion under Rule 56F seeking to take more discovery before responding to the summary judgment motion?
No, Your Honor, we did not file a motion under Rule 56F. We filed a motion to strike and a motion to in the alternative.
There's nothing wrong with affidavits from anybody. In fact, you can file a motion for summary judgment the day after the complaint is filed. There's no need to have discovery before the motion. The procedure, if you need more discovery to respond to the motion, is provided by Rule 56F. Now, it sounds like you just sought the wrong thing, that is, throwing the affidavits away, rather than seeking an opportunity to gather evidence on your own.
But, Your Honor, the motion that we filed actually asked for all of that relief from the district court.
So is your point that simply you forgot to type Rule 56F at the top of your alternative motion? Forget about the motion to strike right now. Your alternative motion said we would like additional time to take the depositions of these three individuals?
No, Your Honor, because we did not feel that a Rule 56 affidavit was proper under these circumstances because discovery had closed.
Well, what's the difference between a Rule 56 request and what you were asking for, which was also depositions after discovery has closed?
If the court determined that these affidavits should be considered, we believed that because these witnesses were not disclosed under Rule 26A, they were not disclosed in response to a Rule 30b-6 deposition notice that specifically requested the person or persons that had the evidence that these witnesses later testified to, and because we specifically asked in our discovery request for all persons that the defendant was going to use to support any of their affirmative defenses or support their defense to our case. We did not feel that a Rule 56 affidavit was appropriate when we filed the motion to strike. Additionally, if the district court is going
to... Your position has to be that you preserved the alternative remedy, that you didn't keep from the district court the idea that an alternative remedy would be allowing you to depose these three people.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we did preserve that remedy on the record appropriately.
Remember that, yeah.
Right. We preserved that record appropriately. If the district court was going to apply the rules of civil procedure with such precision to the plaintiff's side, why then were the defendants allowed to not comply with rules 26A and E? The 26E specifically states that you have a duty to seasonably supplement your responses to discovery when it becomes clear that you are going to be using new witnesses and new information to support your case. That is not what the defendants did here. Therefore, under Rule 37, the automatic sanctions provision should have applied and these affidavits should have been struck. There was no reason that the defendants did not disclose these witnesses despite the fact that discovery had been ongoing for 2 years.
Now, the alternative ground that the district court suggests is essentially, so what? I mean, even if we disregard these affidavits, is it possible to find functionally this information, corporate structure information, billing reference information, in other documents before the court?
No, Your Honor. The district court specifically disregarded the material facts that the plaintiffs presented in opposition to the defendant's Rule 56.1 statement. We specifically showed that Communications and Cable of Chicago was subject to the FDCPA pursuant to Section 1692A6 of the Act. under that provision, if somebody is using a name other than their own to collect an alleged debt, then they are liable under Section 1692A6. And therefore, the district court ignored that evidence that we produced. AT&T Broadband contends that they did not violate the FDCPA because they went ahead and applied the assumed name AT&T in conjunction with the word broadband.
But the trademark AT&T, isn't that what they said?
Well,
in conjunction with the word broadband?
They stated that they used the trademark AT&T, but this absolutely flies in the face of reason. This was hearsay testimony based upon the affidavit of somebody who we did not have the opportunity to depose. This individual, Frank Colley.
When you say it was hearsay, you mean it was without personal knowledge whether they had been licensed to use the AT&T trademark?
The affidavit says very vaguely that there was an oral license agreement that Communications and Cable of Chicago had to use the trademark
right.
AT&T.
So is it your position that that affidavit was made by somebody who lacked personal knowledge of that fact?
He did not specifically testify as to when exactly that oral agreement took place. He didn't have the proper foundation. He did not have the proper foundation.
Was there reason to believe that he wouldn't know whether there was such an alleged oral license agreement?
Well, Your Honors, we never even had the opportunity to test his affidavit and to test his credibility. The district court simply took everything that he said as true and applied that and said that, well, these are the undisputed facts.
But this is in one of these affidavits that you're challenging.
Absolutely.
The alleged oral agreement. So apart from this challenged affidavit, there's no evidence in the record of any license agreement running from AT&T to CCC.
That is correct. The record is completely silent. Without this affidavit, there is absolutely no reason to believe that Communications and Cable of Chicago was licensed to use this name. And that's where the deception occurred.
Counsel, could you tell me how your clients were injured under the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act?
My clients were injured because they did not know the identity of their creditor. When they thought that their monies were owed to AT&T Broadband LLC, it is very reasonable that a jury would conclude that that consumer might pay that debt first if there were other debts in dispute.
Why is that?
Because the FDCPA applies to debt collectors, but it also applies to creditors in situations where you have creditors who are posing as somebody else in an attempt to collect alleged debts. You cannot use the leverage of another name in order to induce payment, and that's the damage my client suffered.
I guess I'm not understanding how using AT&T Broadband is significant, where they're more apt to pay them than the creditor they didn't know was providing the service.
Well, Your Honor, that would have been a question of fact for the jury to decide, but we weren't allowed to get to that point. Moreover, there are statutory damages available under the FDCPA for any violation of the law, whether it's technical or substantive. So in reality,
that's why I asked how your clients were damaged.
Exactly. They did not even need to show any actual damage, but here they testified as to their confusion. The issue.
Well, they actually filed a lawsuit. Somebody, one of them, filed a lawsuit at one point against AT&T, and AT&T rushed in and said, oh, no, you know, we're the wrong party.
Exactly. That's another reason why there was such confusion. What happened was that because all of the statements of service, all the payment coupon bills, all the debt collection letters said, pay AT&T Broadband, and then they used the address of AT&T Broadband LLC. So when my client actually disputed that he owed money on his cable services account, he originally filed a lawsuit in state court and sued AT&T Broadband LLC. Their contention was, we're not the appropriate party. In fact, your creditor is really Communications and Cable of Chicago. This case might have been different had the Communications and Cable of Chicago not been using the name of another company. But because you are involving a third party here, it leads the consumer to believe that someone else is involved in the collection of these debts. And that's what happened here. Because of the violations of Section 1692A6 and J, there was a false belief that AT&T Broadband LLC was involved in the collection of these debts. There were disputed issues of fact also as to AT&T Broadband LLC's involvement in the design and compilation of the forms that went to my clients.
Which forms are we talking about here? Because I think there's a distinction, or there's, the briefs are talking past each other in this respect, in that AT&T Broadband is focusing on the precise debt collection letter, and you seem to be talking about other forms.
Exactly, Your Honor. We are not speaking solely about the debt collection letter. We do not dispute that the one debt collection letter at issue originally was a collection letter sent from Credit Protection Association. But my client's debts were in dispute well before Credit Protection Association even became involved with the collection of these debts. Communications and Cable of Chicago apparently also has an internal collections department, and my client, Joseph Rydell, testified that he received phone calls from AT&T Broadband trying to collect his debts. He disputed these debts and was receiving past due statements of service. So in addition to the debt collection letter, which says, pay AT&T Broadband at AT&T Broadband LLC's address, you also have past due statements of service that say, pay AT&T Broadband, and direct payment, again, to the P.O. box of AT&T Broadband LLC.
Now, consumers are entitled to contest debts, of course. Are you alleging that the problem is he's telling the wrong company, or his problem, I mean, the confusion here is that he was telling the wrong company that he was disputing the amount of the debt?
Well, we don't know, Your Honor. We actually don't know who my client ended up disputing his debts to, and that's part of the problem. When we interviewed or deposed AT&T Broadband's corporate representative, Richard Balcom, he could not even testify as to which entity he worked for. So really what you have is just this conglomeration of small local cable companies that don't have any employees, and they're all operating under a trade name. So when my client makes a phone call, they don't even really know which entity they are disputing the debt with. And that's a fundamental problem.
What was the dispute of the debt your client claimed?
Originally, my client, Joseph Rydell, and Ms. Gutierrez disputed that they were charged for installation services, and they were promised a caption, or they were promised certain, promised a package of free HBO and Showtime for a certain amount, and then they were actually charged for that amount. So they disputed that they owed those amounts, and those are the amounts that went to collection. You know, every case that the defendant cites is really dealing with a different set of facts. They're dealing with a creditor and one debt collector. Here we have a situation where you have a creditor posing as another creditor, and that's what furthers the masquerade. Because the district court erred in considering the testimony of these three witnesses, and because we plainly showed that we should have prevailed under Section 1692A6, E14, and J of the FDCPA, we respectfully request that the district court's decision be reversed, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Barta. Ms. Gay.
May it please the court, Your Honors. I'm standing in for Angela Dacre of my firm, who's in trial today. Let me just quickly go through and try to respond to the points raised by the appellant. First of all, there are two counts that are remaining, obviously, in the case. The actual debt collector has settled count one, and there is, Judge Wood, a live state court action in which the point was when they sued AT&T LLC, which, like CCC here, is a subsidiary of AT&T, the response was, it's not AT&T LLC, it's another subsidiary.
No, I understand that. I guess it was rather vivid anecdotal evidence to me that there is some serious confusion out there about who is providing the services, since it appears that CCC's name appeared on nothing that went to this cable subscriber, and all of the things said AT&T Broadband LLC with the Denver post office box.
Or said AT&T Cable Services.
But in terms of who did he pay, you know, what did it say in the bill? And so if one of the things we're trying to get a sense of is our unsophisticated debtor, or even a normal, you know, middle-of-the-road debtor likely to be confused, a name that is never told to the person is a little hard to find.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's precisely the issue, which is throughout both of these plaintiff situations with the various cable services which they bought and didn't pay for,
which they were trying to contest. That's one of the things that worries me, too, because consumers you know, sometimes you'll pick up your Marshall Field's bill and you'll see there's an item on it that you think was erroneously put on it, and you have the right to contact Marshall Field's, say, I contest item number 3, you know, for whatever, $100, and they have to take some steps to make sure it's really a correct charge. Sometimes it's wrong. Mistakes are made. And if you don't know who you're supposed to contact, the whole process goes awry from the start.
And certainly, Your Honor, that's correct. And the whole purpose of these statutes is to protect against fraud. There's not a word in this record that suggests that there was ever any problem in terms of finding...
But what if he told AT&T Broadband LLC about these representations of the salesperson at the time the service was established, and AT&T Broadband LLC said, we don't know anything about that, we're not the right ones to talk to, it's CCC, and all of a sudden the thing goes off to the credit, to the CPA people. I mean, there are real problems underlying this thing. But anyway, I don't want to...
And Judge, I think that's right, hypothetically. I don't think that's what the basis is in the record here. Let me just outline what the two counts are.
I know what the two counts are. Can you tell me exactly who Richard Balcom worked for? Because I'm looking at an excerpt of his deposition, and he was extraordinarily vague about that question.
And with regard to that, the at the time of the deposition, I believe it was there was an AT&T Broadband and CCC were subsidiaries of AT&T, and there was a little unclear what he was called to testify to. The 30B6 asked him to testify as to what each of the entities that AT&T owned. At that time, it was CCC and AT&T Broadband.
But who did he work for? He at one point says, he's identifying CPA, and he says, they are an outside collections firm that we, first person plural, utilize for collections on delinquent accounts. And then the question comes, and who is we? And he responds, AT&T Broadband. And then the question, and just so we're clear, you do not mean AT&T Broadband LLC. And he says, no, I don't mean that. I mean the local offices here in Chicago area operating as AT&T Broadband. And then he's asked, so is it CCC you're referring to? And he says, no, that's not what I'm referring to. Who the heck is he referring to?
He's referring to AT&T, the corporate parent, which is the owner.
Their name isn't AT&T Broadband.
That's right, AT&T Broadband.
He at least doesn't know who his corporate parent is if he thinks the corporate parent is named AT&T Broadband.
AT&T Broadband, right, was in fact a description that cannot in fact be trademarked in any way.
I understand. Your theory is that he gets his paycheck, I think, from a trade name. But he says, we AT&T Broadband use the firm. But he doesn't, but AT&T Broadband isn't LLC, and it isn't CCC, and it's certainly not the parent corporation.
No, it's simply
a
trade name that has been used by the cable subsidiary.
So can you answer this question? Who uses CPA for collections?
AT&T? AT&T.
But in this case,
yes.
Your position, I thought, had been that AT&T, the parent, had nothing to do with collecting the Gutierrez and
that's right, CCC and
Rydell account.
That CCC and Chicago Cable.
But Mr. Balcom said CCC didn't do it.
With regard to the representation by Mr. Balcom, every one of AT&T's subsidiaries, which includes both of the defendants here, used the debt collection agency and just passed on through their computer billing to the debt collection agency.
Let me back up and say, I mean, this case is about whether there are disputed issues of material fact, and it's sort of subsidiarily about whether you are entitled to rely on these three depositions, Heller, Politano, and Rizek. It seems to me that the identity of the creditor is crucial to the question whether the somebody's trying to operate under the wrong name, and it does seem to me that it's awfully hard in this record to tell who was doing what. And so it strikes me that summary judgment may have been premature, at least on that point. And with respect to Mr. Politano, the excerpt in the deposition where you say they were supposed to know that it was Mr. Politano is just, do you know who Mr. Politano is? Do you know who Frank Politano is? Answer, no, I do not. That, in your view, is enough trigger somebody to say, oh, we better go take Mr. Politano's deposition?
Well, also, Your Honor, his position was listed elsewhere. And when you look at the facts that they are saying prejudice them here, which is on page 18 of their brief, they say, for example, that AT&T Broadband was owned by the parent company of AT&T in the public record. The fact that AT&T was branded in connection with the words broadband and cable services in their complaint.
Well, that I know that, except that your position is a little contradictory here, because on the one hand you're saying AT&T has had this trademark forever and ever. On the other hand, you rush off 3 months later after this suit starts and file a trademark application for AT&T Broadband. Interesting behavior. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know what to make of the obligation under Rule 30 to designate people if, in fact, there really is no such obligation and it's the burden on the opposing party simply to read through all the documents that have been filed and do their own designation of corporate representatives.
Well, a couple of things, Judge. With regard to Rule 30b-6, the designee is presented for testimony.
Mr. Falcom was an embarrassment.
And if there is an objection, Judge, certainly there are provisions in the federal rules that make a motion to compel.
But whose burden is it to find the right person? Why should it be the plaintiff's burden to say, we think you know there's somebody who knows more? Maybe you're just a badly run company, and Mr. Balcom's the best you have.
Well, with regard to that could be true. But with the 30b-6 designation, there is a very well-settled provision for responding to answers that are inadequate, which is a motion to compel a better answer. Just say that this witness is totally inadequate as a corporate representative. Never happened here. With regard to the two counts, though, Judge, just to be clear, I think the trademark and licensing issue is a complete red herring. Count 2, which is against LLC, simply alleges very clearly that they compiled, put together, composed,
lots of forms that said AT&T Broadband. The statutory language doesn't say debt collection forms. It says forms.
But, Your Honor, that complaint alleges very specifically the debt collection forms at issue. In counts 2 and 3, it says, and this is extremely specific and clear allegations, there were sent collection letters bearing Credit Protection Association's letterhead. No deception there. We stopped the collecting alleged debt by AT&T Broadband, the same company with the trucks that drove up to their house.
Who do these people believe were providing their service when they dealt with as they came to install it and so forth? Did they have?
Yeah, both of these deponents were deposed. I mean, both of these plaintiffs were deposed, and they said AT&T is who they dealt with. And they got bills that said AT&T Cable, AT&T Broadband. They believed it was AT&T. It was never an issue of, oh my goodness, it's some other company, and we are hiding the ball from you in some way consistently throughout.
Until you told them they were suing the wrong person.
But we told them, Your Honor, they were suing the wrong person in LLC. That case is still alive. AT&T is still in the case. It's just they were suing the wrong subsidiary. So it's not as if they have been thrown out of state court in any way, shape, or form. So, again, there's not a word in this record that LLC had anything to do with these debt collection forms that are alleged in count 2. On count 3, which is against CCC only, CCC just did not act as a debt collector, again, as to the debt collection letters that are alleged specifically in count 3 or as to anything else.
The point is not that they're a debt collector. The point is they're using a false name.
Well, the point is, Judge, that under count 3,
that is not their name.
They have to be a debt collector to be eligible.
Or a creditor can be under the statute if they're using a false name.
If they reach 3 requirements, one is which they're actually doing the debt collection themselves, which they are not. And there are legions of cases where there's much more involvement by the creditor than is the case here, where they're not termed a debt collector. 3 separate elements. Secondly, with regard to using a false name, the case law holds consistently that all that is required is that you use the same name you used when you contacted the customer. In fact, the cases chastise creditors for when they use their technical registered trademark name when they've been actually using a colloquial alias all along. So under those 2 sets of clear holdings, Judge, there is just no liability with regard to CCC being a debt collector for purposes of 1692E. In terms of this argument about trademark and licensing, it's not a trademark case. The judge found that the Illinois business practices statute had been met fully, but again, it's not an allegation in this case. The judge found that, in fact, it protected these plaintiffs by the client or by the creditor using the same name throughout. It's a question of whether a license is needed. It's not. It's the usage of the name over time. These were red herrings that were presented at the very last moment. Judge, to address your other question about the proper discovery relief here, again, there was no motion to compel with regard to 30B6.
Aren't you being really picky, though? Because the fact is, if they've moved to take the depositions of these three people, what difference does it make? They've asked the district court for the precise relief that would address the problem, namely your late discovery of these three people when you can't make out your summary judgment papers with Mr. Balcom's testimony.
Well, with regard to that, Judge,
they asked the district court for that relief. Why isn't it abuse of discretion to deny it?
What they asked for, and what the record very much supports here, is they asked that these affiant's records be stricken.
But they asked in the alternative to take the deposition.
Judge, I'm not seeing that in the record. But with regard to that, even if they did ask for it, if you look at the information that they seek to take here, which they were not unnoticed, none of it is relevant or dispositive to the claims that are at issue here. Now, their big problem is that there was an in-house counsel who testified at one point. That person moved on to another company, and there was a substitute affiant who said exactly the same thing that had been said for now 4 years in the state court action, which is still live against AT&T, CCC. And with regard to that, there's no prejudice. The rules are not to play gotcha, which is not what we're doing here. The rules are to get the information out here. And simply stated, Your Honor, these plaintiffs have received service from the same representation, AT&T, from beginning to finish. These plaintiffs have not a word in the record that they could not find a way to get information on their bill. In fact, they avoided paying their bill. These plaintiffs have never said that, oh, CCC came to me and suggested that it had nothing to do with AT&T. Moreover,
well, there basically is no CCC, right? Well, just a shell subsidiary?
It's a franchisee that uses the AT&T name.
Anybody work for it?
Technical people do, but it's not a large company. And it's in the same situation as any other cable provider, that the parent is AT&T. And it was not as if AT&T was hiding the ball here in any way, shape, or form. Respectfully, Your Honor, I'll rely on my brief unless there are other questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Ms. Barta?
I think some interesting points were made regarding how my clients could possibly not have been confused. Simply put, I think this whole lawsuit could have been avoided if the defendants would have simply put a doing business as designation on these forms. That would have put my clients on notice that a name was being used and yet they could still identify their creditor's name. The Second Circuit has stated in the case of McGuire versus Citicorp, which is cited in the brief, that the issue of consumer confusion under these sections of the FDCPA dealing with creditor liability is not something that can be determined as a matter of law, but it's something that's a question of fact. My clients were confused, they testified as to that confusion, and yet the district court just rejected that testimony and found summary judgment in defendant's favor. Now, some other interesting points were made that I believe need to be clarified. We absolutely did ask for the right to depose these witnesses and the alternative to our motion to strike. Also, I'm concerned that there was testimony that Communications and Cable of Chicago has some employees. There was actually a request to admit fact answered by the defendants where Communications and Cable of Chicago actually has no employees. You know, the question here is how many hundreds of employees would we have to depose if the district court's decision was taken as and it is governing. In this district, then, what's going to happen is if a name is mentioned in deposition, throughout the course, maybe 30 names are mentioned, a plaintiff's attorney or a defendant's attorney is going to have to depose every single one of those representatives. We could be taking 15, 20 depositions per side, and I just don't think that would be in the interest of any form of judicial economy. There simply were disputed issues of fact here. The defendants should have been using a doing business as designation, and for these reasons, the district court's decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.